Morning.
Morning.
First, I represent Graylin Nowden, who is an employee of the Division of Alcohol and Tobacco Control, which is a subunit of the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Nowden was a special agent for a number of years. He got into a situation where the department conducted an investigation and then summarily terminated his employment on October 1st, 2013. Your docket summary of this case is actually very good. It was better than the one I prepared, so I'll kind of refer you to that. The central issue, of course, is whether the petition that I filed in circuit court was subject to dismissal for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. There are a number of sort of sub-issues that spring off of that, which is in your summary, and I believe to be correct. The easy answer in this case, I think, is that the department takes the position that they terminated Nowden's employment pursuant to section 311.620, which on its face appears to provide authority for the department to terminate an employee immediately upon a finding that they were involved in the operation of a liquor establishment. And ostensibly, that's what the division did. They terminate him immediately without any procedural due process, pre-deprivation. They did inform him that he was subject to policy G2. Now, policy G2 is a right to appeal. It is not a right to a hearing. So, any way you look at it, the department terminated Nowden's employment without a hearing and without a right to a hearing. And therefore, by its very definition, that procedure, that process, would be a non-contested case. And a non-contested case is not subject to a requirement to exhaust any administrative remedy.
But didn't you bring your petition for review as a contested case in your first amended petition, which is what the trial court ruled on?
Yes. I filed a petition saying that it was a contested case because under the Missouri and United States Constitution, Nowden had a constitutionally protected property right in his job, and therefore he could not be terminated without due process, and he could but not be terminated without a contested case review. A contested case review, of course, is defined under Chapter 536, and so it was my belief that he was entitled to a contested case hearing prior to his termination, and for that he never had any opportunity.
But you sought relief in circuit court as to review a contested case. Is that correct?
Not exactly. The review was of what they had given him, which was a non-contested case. What I argued in the circuit court, and I believe it's consistent with Byrd and Yarber, this court's previous pronouncement on contested cases, that a party has the right to file for a contested case review before the circuit court when none was provided in the agency.
Well, whether you're entitled to, whether it's contested or uncontested is a question of law. It's whether a hearing is required by law that has certain characteristics. Doesn't matter what you call it, it's what it is.
Yes, ma'am, that is correct.
You can't turn something into contested if it's uncontested by law or vice versa.
That is correct.
Okay. So what was this under G2, is it, and under the other policies, is you said you were entitled to a contested case hearing, but looking at the provisions of the statute and the policy, you argue, I believe in the brief, it's uncontested because there was no required hearing, even though it was optional?
That is correct. The policy actually given to Nowden was a non-contested case. There wasn't even any review. I guess what the question could evolve into is, had they provided Nowden with the rights guaranteed under policy G2, he would have had 7 days prior to his termination to file an appeal, but he still wouldn't have a right to a hearing. Policy G2 makes it discretionary as to whether the department director will even grant a hearing. He has four options. He can just ask for more information. He can hold what they call an informal hearing, which is not an informal hearing at all, it's just a meeting, or he can agree with the decision to discipline, and that's the end of the matter. He also has the option to convene this hearing, but in my reading of the hearing that is even a possibility under policy G2, that doesn't satisfy the requirements of a contested case for a number of reasons. And so there's no opportunity for Nowden to have had a contested case other than in some other tribunal. My thinking was, perhaps incorrectly, that he had an option under Chapter 36, which governs state employees, in particular merit system employees. It has a default provision for agencies that don't adopt contested case procedures, then they're required to follow Chapter 36. My thinking was that Nowden was entitled to review there, and that's where I originally filed. The AHC, which now stands in place of the PAB, determined that he did not have a right to a hearing before the Administrative Hearing Commission, and then my only option left, that, as I could see it, was filing in Circuit Court and asking Circuit Court to conduct de novo review or contested case review. I don't think it really matters. I mean, what matters is...
Well, it affects whether you take new evidence in the Circuit Court or whether you try it on the record in the... And it may or may not affect whether or not you have to exhaust your administrative remedies.
Well, you only have to exhaust administrative remedies when you had one or had the opportunity to have one or a record was made for which there would be judicial
review.
Well,
that would be... One question is that Strowski, I can't pronounce it.
Strowski.
Was it correctly decided when it said you don't have to exhaust your administrative remedies in the case of an uncontested case?
Yes, Strzeski was correctly decided because the procedures given to Strzeski did not amount to a contested case, and therefore he didn't have to exhaust.
But why not? I mean, the case that Strzeski cites doesn't actually say that. It says the fact that you're entitled to pursue an administrative appeal and file something administratively doesn't mean you can't sue in circuit court if you have a separate common law claim, their breach of contract. And it was cited in that case, which I still can't pronounce, as for authority that you don't have to appeal to the AHC or a comparable body. That might be a good policy, but can you address the policy issues? Why would that be the case? Or legally, could we interpret it that way if there was an administrative remedy on appeal, even if it wasn't a contested case?
Right. As I understand the case law as it's developed, it has become pretty clear that absent a real administrative remedy that's adequate to develop a case like in a contested case that could be reviewed by a circuit court, then the party doesn't have to exhaust that remedy. That's Strzeski. Strzeski had a grievance procedure which did not amount to...
That's what it said. Did it correctly interpret the statute is what I'm asking you. It based it on the statute and said the statute doesn't require exhaustion.
It seems to me that question hinges on what the definition of administrative review is.
Okay.
And in my thought, administrative review is some meaningful review that then can be judicially reviewed. If you have a grievance process or, you know, an appeal process that says you can ask your boss nicely to give you your job back, you know, is that something that you have to exhaust when you're sitting under a 30-day deadline, possibly, to file a request for a contested case? And it seems to me that anything that muddies the waters is not good. Anything that muddies the waters may deprive, in our case, a state employee of a constitutionally protected right because the procedures are so confusing you can't figure out where you go next. And you could end up, as in our case, you could end up spending, according to their rule, 45 days waiting to find out if you're really going to get a hearing after the director decides you are going to get a hearing at his discretion, so you'd be time barred there. So I think that it's a bad idea to require the exhaustion of a remedy that is not a true administrative remedy. That is, it does not provide a record for review. Otherwise, you could really be screwed out of your chance for a hearing. The dissent in Strzeski, which is what is really kind of interesting, they cite two cases. One is the, oh, let me get it. The Forget case, which was a zoning case. And it's true that where there is a specific statute that provides that your remedy is to go through some administrative process that may be less than a contested case, then you've got to follow it. I think that's particularly true in a case where you don't have, as in our case, a constitutionally protected property right governed by case law, governed by the Constitution, not case law, that says you're entitled to a contested case. So that's sort of, you know, there's the general rule and then there's the exception. If you've got a specific statute that says what you have to do and that statute is constitutionally sufficient, you have to follow it. The other case is Peters. In that case, a hearing was required under Chapter 260, which is a contested case. So where you have the opportunity for a true contested case, you must exhaust. Where you have a specific statute that says you have to exhaust a remedy so that something less than a contested case, then you probably have to exhaust that too because you may have no other right. In Strzuski, that's where you get back to the Strzuski case. He had a right to a grievance. He had no constitutionally protected property right that I could tell in that case. And so his only remedy was this grievance. And what the dissent says, well, he should have had to follow it. And I think what you have, the law is what you have to follow is one that the legislature has said you have to follow. And that was not the case in Strzuski. And that is not the case in my case. It was the case in Forget and Peters. But the general rule, I think, is still valid where there is not administrative review that's meaningful, that is, that involves a contested case, then you don't have to exhaust, absent a statutory exception, of which there are many. There is not in this case. The best that you could say in this case, I suppose, is that there's a statute that provides for a contested case for now in the Personal Advisory Board, now the AHC, and I exhausted that. So, got a yellow light.
You want to cede the rest of your time?
No, I'll wait.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Joshua Devine, Deputy Solicitor for the State, appearing on behalf of the Division. This case presents a number of side issues, contested case, non-contested case, but regardless of how this court decides those issues, the same conclusion follows. Nowden was required to exhaust administrative remedies regardless, and his failure to do so deprived the circuit court of authority to proceed. Now, I'll begin first with what I think is his biggest counterargument, which is his assertion that because the appeals process concerns terminations before they take effect, that this termination took effect immediately, that there simply wasn't and there simply weren't any remedies to exhaust. That argument fails for two reasons. First, the policy expressly applies to Nowden. The very first page of the policy states that, quote, all adverse action taken against an employee, it states that it will apply in those circumstances. Now, to be sure, there is a conflict between this policy and state statute. The policy states that a person should ordinarily have the opportunity to appeal before a termination takes effect. And in a discrete number of small circumstances, the legislature has stated that a person must be fired immediately. But it would be a mistake to say that this conflict erases the policy.
Why is there a conflict? Immediately after what?
Immediately after, so the statute says that if a person, quote, shall violate the provisions of this chapter, then the person shall be immediately
discharged.
And
how do we know if they have? If it says shall violate, is it when their boss thinks they have? It's when they get the first decision below? It's when the circuit court affirms? It's when this court affirms? How do we know when they shall have violated?
Well, Judge Stiff, if there wasn't the term immediately, I think there'd be a lot of ambiguity as to who gets to make that determination.
Immediately but, after what?
Well, because the legislature inserted that term immediately, I think the first person who has any firing authority who comes to that determination must fire the individual.
And is there any case law interpreting this or some other statute on that when there's language like this which doesn't say when at what point?
Not that I'm aware of. But the ordinary statute omits this time language. It omits things like immediately. And here the legislature intentionally inserted that. Now the Department of Public Safety director has authority to fire, but the division director also has authority to fire. That's in two statutes, section 650.005 and section 311.610. And so I think the insertion of that term immediately requires that the very first person who makes that determination that a person has violated Chapter 311, and here there's really no dispute that he did violate that chapter, the very first person who has that authority who makes that determination must fire him. So this court should home in on this conflict and determine that the state law preempts this discrete provision in the policy and should read those in harmony. So reading these together, the state statute and the policy simply change when the person gets to appeal.
How would it do that, though? It says you get 7 days before it takes effect, assuming they are in conflict. It doesn't turn it into 7 days after. Is there some other provision that that governs what happens once you're terminated generally?
No, Your Honor, but this court's ordinary process for engaging in a conflict analysis is to construe everything as valid and take only those provisions that are expressly irreconcilable. And I think it's simply this timing factor that is irreconcilable.
But you're saying, I think, or did I misunderstand? You're saying the 7 days would apply to after? And I'm wondering how that would be, or do you get 30 days, or how long would he have?
The 7 days would apply after, and indeed that has been the express understanding of the parties at the very beginning of this case. The division took that position in the letter. It stated policy G2 applies, and indeed Nowden signed a form understanding that he understood that it was the position of the division that policy G2 applied, and then he had this appeal right. And indeed, 2 days after the appeal was due, he actually submitted appeals papers. So he understood that he had this right to appeal as well.
Well, he's contested that he said he got 7 days notice prior. So he's not concurred that he wasn't entitled to that notice.
But he has, at least initially, he didn't contest that the appeals policy applied.
It's a question of law, not what you agree to. Is that right? Is there any interpretation in the case of a conflict when you're entitled to a certain period of pre-deprivation notice? You're saying the time period flips over and applies after determination, and I haven't seen any cases suggesting
that. Nor have I. I think this is a little bit of an unusual situation, but again, the conflict analysis that this court ordinarily engages in is to home in on the specific provisions that are irreconcilable, and which would leave in place the 7 days following the decision. But even if this policy doesn't apply, he's cited no authority whatsoever that would prohibit the division from going above and beyond their ordinary duties and providing him more process than they would ordinarily be required to provide.
The test for a contested and uncontested case is what's required by law, and not what's optional. Because
right.
You can't not know till after they decide to give you something.
Right. My argument is specifically as to whether there were remedies to be exhausted. This isn't quite getting into the non-contested-contested issue. But as to that issue, this court need not decide that issue, which is a little bit thorny. Because even if his case is non-contested, then this court should hold that he would still have to exhaust administrative remedies. And this court doesn't have to travel far to find authority for that proposition. Indeed, the non-contested statute expressly states that. The non-contested statute says that it is available only if there is no other judicial remedy through which a person can obtain relief, and there is no opportunity for administrative appeal. So this statute is essentially a stopgap statute. It applies only if there is no governing body, judicial or administrative, through which a person can hear an appeal. That constitutes an exhaustion requirement. So the problem is not the statute. I think the text is plain. The problem is this court's decision in Strzuski. And I think Strzuski has become an administrative nightmare. And I think this court need look no further than the cases it is hearing today. In one of those, the Court of Appeals cited Strzuski and said, well, there is no exhaustion requirement. And the same division of the Court of Appeals, in a separate case, cited the plain text of the statute and said, there is an exhaustion requirement. Indeed, this court has done the same thing in Impey against Missouri Ethics Commission. Without citing Strzuski, this court cited the statute and applied the plain text of that statute. And so Impey is directly irreconcilable with this specific holding in Strzuski.
Well, it's dicta in a footnote, because that wasn't the facts of the case. It doesn't mean it's incorrect. Can you address how we read the statute?
Yes. I don't think it's dicta, Judge Stith, and here's why. There the court expressly said there was an issue as to whether the case was contested or non-contested, and the court said that it did not need to reach that issue because even if the case were non-contested, the person would still have to exhaust administrative review. I read that not as dicta, but as an alternative holding to defeat a counterargument that one of these sides had presented. But so Impey is directly irreconcilable, if that is a holding, with Strzuski. And under ordinary hands of stare decisis, the latter case controls. So I think this case should make express what Impey made implicit.
And I know you cite some older cases of this court saying we can overrule our prior cases sub silentio, but we have numerous cases in the last 10 years that say we don't do that, that we don't sub silentio overrule prior Supreme Court precedent. So if that's the case, you're asking us, if this court were to find that we don't sub silencio do it, so MP didn't do that. What are your reasons why this court should do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's why we're here today. And again, the two cases before us today, I think if Strzuski is allowed to maintain this dissonance with the statute, what we're going to have is we're going to have litigants who repeatedly cite the statute who may not uncover Strzuski in their research, and we're going to have exactly what we have today, which is the Court of Appeals going two different directions depending on whether they cited Strzuski or not. Because the text is plain. The text is a stopgap measure. It applies only if there is no other possibility for any kind of appeal, whether judicial or whether administrative. Now, I think this court should hold that Strzuski is expressly overruled for these administrative reasons. But as Judge Powell and as Judge Sith, as you stated earlier, this case, or as you suggested earlier, this case can also be adjudicated on much simpler grounds, which is by holding Nowden to his pleadings. In his first amended petition, he raises this as a contested case, and he cites the statutes for a contested case. Now, as this court stated in the Signal Point Asset Management case, it is axiomatic that a person is bound by the cause of action which he asserts. He cannot assert that this is a contested case in his petition and then come on appeal and say, actually, it's really a non-contested case.
If the court were to follow that logic and follow that argument, what would be the proper remedy then? Shouldn't the circuit court at least entertain an opportunity to amend the petition so they could bring a petition in as a non-contested case?
Well, we don't know why the circuit court denied the petition, but I don't think they would be entitled to it under these circumstances, given the delay. For example, in January 2016, they requested that their second amended petition be withdrawn. It's not until March 2016 that they requested be reinstated. And when the court did not immediately rule on that, there's nothing in the docket that suggests that they, you know, called the clerk's office or asked for it to be ruled upon. I think the circuit court was well within its authority to implicitly overrule that motion, given that the litigant's position had changed repeatedly and that he hadn't acted quickly in an attempt to reinstate that second amended petition.
But because he did first ask for contested case review and then amend and ask for non-contested case review, and you all have been disagreeing throughout this process as to which was appropriate. So you're saying right. What kind of review you're entitled to is as a matter of law, but you're saying if he incorrectly cited the statute under which he was entitled to have review, then that would throw him out of court as opposed to simply being
yes.
An error.
Yes, Your Honor. In Green against St. Louis, that comes from this court in 1994, this court's repeatedly construed this as jurisdictional. Now, after the Webb case in 2009, it might be more appropriate to say that this goes to the authority of a court to hear a case. But the point remains that the person must invoke the correct statutory authority. And now they can ordinarily amend a petition, but whereas here we had three attempts to amend, and then with a withdrawal, and then an attempt to further reinstate. At some point, enough is enough, and I think the circuit court was well within its discretion to overrule that attempt to reinstate the second amended petition, especially when it came, you know, in March, 2 months after it was initially removed. Now, if this court determines, as I think it should, that Nowden was required to exhaust his remedies, it need not reach this due process issue. But if it does, I'll leave the court with just two thoughts. One, his assertion that there was no process at all is belied by the record. On September 26th, he was given a copy of the investigation against him. He was expressly told that he has 72 hours to respond to the investigation. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Loudermill case held that a person ordinarily need only have some kind of written or oral opportunity to give his version of the events. So it's indisputable that there was some kind of process beforehand. The only real question is whether he was entitled to the trial-like procedures that courts occasionally hold or required, such as in Goldberg v. Kelly. And I think the Matthews test, specifically the second factor, is essentially dispositive on this issue. There is no risk of erroneous deprivation from the process that was afforded to Nowden. In fact, he didn't even make use of that process. But it's uncontested that he admitted that he worked at A&D Mini Mart, which was a covered business. And Chapter 311 expressly states that a person who is an employee or agent of a covered business must be fired immediately. This wasn't even a matter of discretion, as in Loudermill. The division director was required to terminate him, and it's indisputable that he violated that section. There's no additional process that could have reduced the risk of error in this case. So to briefly conclude, this case has dragged on for nearly 5 years, and the reason we are here, I think, is because Strzuski has proven to be inadministrable. I think this court should expressly overrule Strzuski and hold that the plain text requires exhaustion in all circumstances. Unless the court has any further questions, we'll rest the remainder on our briefs.
The motions for summary judgment that the court ruled upon and considered and evaluated were on their face based on the Second Amendment petition. Whether the docket sheet...
The judgment says it's dismissing the First Amendment petition.
It does indeed. And whether that's a mistake on the docket sheet or I didn't make it clear or somebody didn't make it clear that we were actually proceeding on the Second Amendment, I don't know.
But the opposing counsel says you withdrew the Second Amendment, and so you had to be proceeding on the first because the second wasn't there anymore.
Logically, that's correct. What we have, though, is the judge issuing a judgment on the First Amendment petition, which took into consideration the arguments on summary judgment.
And summary judgment did argue contested, uncontested?
It did. And so if the respondent's argument should have carried any weight, they should have filed a motion for rehearing or new trial or something to correct the judgment at the trial court level, or perhaps raised it in the Western District, which they did not. And raising it here at this point seems a little late.
Well, can you address opposing counsel's argument that you had to know which it was, which kind of review you were asking for when you filed your petition in circuit court and had to make a choice or plead them in the alternative, but you didn't do that?
It depends on how you read that First Amended petition. I certainly alleged in the First Amended that policy G2 did not comply with the contested case review. And so arguably that would be broad enough for the court to consider, and it did consider, whether we had to exhaust administrative remedies in this case or not. I disagree with my opponent on the irreconcilable decisions of this court in MP, and for that matter in Hagley. In both of those cases, there was a specific statutory requirement to exhaust those remedies. And that's why MP and Hagley are correctly decided, because there was a contested case procedure by statute that the person had to go through, and so they're required to exhaust. In our case, there was not. In our case, there wasn't any opportunity at all. They said Nowden was subject to immediate termination, so he had no pre-termination rights, no hearing rights, nothing, according to them. That sounds like a non-contested case to me. So, Impey was a Missouri Ethics Commission case, and the court specifically said that Impey had a right to a contested case, and he had to follow the procedures at least till he got to that point. And had that been the case with Nowden, then I would have said that we have an irreconcilable difference, but we do not.
Can you address opposing counsel's argument that none of this really matters because you're required to be you couldn't hold the certificate anyway, weren't permitted to be an agent because of ownership of the conflicting companies?
I believe the application of that statute as the department's done in this case would be unconstitutional, because Nowden clearly had a constitutionally protected property interest in his job. He was entitled to some degree of procedural due process. Under my analysis in my brief, because there was no post-termination procedure whatsoever available to him, that they were required to give him a full contested case hearing before he was terminated.
I think what he's arguing is maybe you had to show prejudice, and in the absence of some facts that would have shown you shouldn't have been terminated, you haven't identified anything that would have prevented it had you gotten that hearing. Is that correct? Do you need to show us that had you gotten the hearing, there would have been evidence you could have presented?
Yes, and those facts are facts that I argued before the Western District on that argument. But it wasn't a nullity that he received due process. That had he received due process, he could have explained the surrounding circumstances why he, a special agent for 23 years, was very aware of what his obligations were and felt that he had not crossed the line in helping the family member who had a liquor store. And certainly the department director could have taken into consideration his many years of service and had a lesser discipline. That's absolutely true.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.